From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out what the city of Fresno is doing to help homeless veterans get back on their feet. We'll also talk to the city's new fire chief, Carrie Donis. She's the first woman to hold the job, and we'll find out about the challenges the department faces and about her own story. Later in the show, we'll go to Bakersfield and find out about a new art exhibit that opens this Friday for First Fridays, which is actually a part of our Voices of the Drought series. But first, the San Joaquin Valley faces a lot of challenges when it comes to the issue of health. But while asthma and obesity may receive much of the attention, mental health is too often overlooked as a major concern. And it's not just a problem in big cities like Bakersfield and Fresno. As FM89's Deanna Aguilera reports, rural residents face their own challenges and barriers to seeking help.
Many women across the Central Valley have dedicated their lives to their families. They take on the daily task of being a housewife.
Mi nombre es Silvia, y simplemente Silvia.
Meet Silvia, a housewife from Mendota. Like many other women in rural communities, she's devoted her life to her two sons and husband, always greeting them with a smile and home-cooked dinners when they arrive home. But about a year ago, her smile started to fade.
Mi esposo se va a trabajar, mi hijo se va a trabajar, mi hijo se va a la escuela, me quedo sola todo el día.
My husband goes to work, my son goes to work, my other son goes to school. I'm left all alone for the entire day. No one to talk to. I started falling into a deep depression.
Silvia says she's not exactly sure what triggered it, but the daily worry of paying bills and managing the limited money they had added more stress and anxiety.
Cuando caí en esa triste depresión tan fuerte, yo ya no me interesaba nada.
When I fell into that deep depression, nothing interested me. I didn't want to watch TV. I didn't want to take a shower. I didn't want to leave the house. I didn't want to change clothes. Nothing interested me. It was like I didn't exist in this world. I lost all hope. I would say, why do I want to live?
Silvia suffered from major depression, and she's not alone. According to a study released last year by the California Healthcare Foundation, the Valley has the highest rates of serious mental illness in the state. The region also has the fewest mental health professionals. In Fresno County, just over 5% of adults have a serious mental illness, diseases like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. The numbers are even higher in surrounding areas, with Madera County reaching 7%.
It's one of the great healthcare needs that I think is under-recognized in some ways, generally in the public.
That's Gary Hoffman, the clinical director at Adventist Health Behavioral Health in Hanford.
Someone who is living paycheck to paycheck or whose future is uncertain due to economic changes and constant relocation. I mean, these stressors become additive, and at some point a person starts giving up.
Local physician Marcia Sablon owned a medical clinic in Fireball with her husband Oscar for more than three decades. She says the Valley's rural communities face unique challenges when it comes to mental health.
A lot of the mental health issues that come up in this town have to do with the socioeconomic status of a lot of the citizens of this town. Our town is about 90% Hispanic, but at the same time, some high percentage of those are undocumented farm workers. So what that leads some people to is unstable state, mostly about their income.
In Sylvia's case, her darkest moments would usually come after her husband and two sons left for the day. She thought she hit rock bottom when she shut herself in her son's bedroom for 15 days without eating.
En esos días yo no pensaba en nada. Lo único que yo hacía era encerrarme en un cuarto.
During those days, I didn't think about anything. I would just stay in a room. He would leave for work and come back, and he would find me in the same spot. I didn't clean the house. I didn't prepare food. I didn't eat. I just laid in bed. My head felt like a whirlwind inside.
Over the course of a few months, Silvia lost almost 40 pounds. Despite major concerns from her family, she was still hesitant to look for help. But it wasn't until she almost took her own life that she realized she needed help.
Un puño de pastillas para tomármelas todas. Yo ya no quería vivir.
I grabbed a handful of pills. I no longer wanted to live. I shoved the pills in my mouth, and that's when I saw my son step out from his room. I snapped out of it, but I felt like someone was tempting me. I took the pills out of my mouth and acted like nothing happened. After that, I understood that I was about to do something really crazy.
With the help of her oldest son, Sylvia went to see her primary care doctor. She remembers sitting quietly in the passenger seat on her way to Fireball.
Knowing that you are going to talk about your problems or how you feel, or simply that you're looking for help, it's scary. You can't talk about this with anyone because if you do, people make fun of you.
She says she was afraid to speak up because of the social stigma linked with mental illness.
I heard a lady say that we were acting, that depression doesn't exist, that people acted this way because they didn't have a job and didn't have anything to do with their lives.
Fresno County's Director of Behavioral Health, Dewan Utek, says that sentiment is all too common in the Valley.
We don't seem to have a problem talking about how high our blood pressure is or what stage our cancer is, but you don't hear people talking about the types of mental illness that they have.
In Sylvia's case, deciding to seek help from a doctor was a big step.
I told the doctor, I'm not crazy. I'm not crazy. I just want help because I don't want to live.
After visiting her primary doctor, Sylvia was referred to a psychiatrist in Fireball and underwent intense counseling for several months. She was finally cleared in March.
I feel happy. I have hope. My life now has meaning. I got my life back.
Back at her home in Mendota, Sylvia still faces many challenges, from finances to work at home. But with the support of her family and her physicians, she's made great progress. Sylvia says she hopes others in her situation will overcome their fears and help break the silence around issues of mental health in the Valley. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
And support for our coverage of health in rural and disadvantaged communities comes from the California Endowment. Deanna Aguilera joins us now in the studio. Deanna, I understand you also talked to Sylvia's family. What was their response seeing this dramatic change in their wife and mother?
Yes, Joe, I did talk to the husband. The two sons weren't there when I interviewed her, but the husband said that at first it really took him a while to realize and acknowledge that she actually was suffering from a mental health disease and illness. He said that he didn't really understand it until he saw that she lost almost 40 pounds. And then with the help of the psychiatrist, he began to be more educated about the subject and realize that it was a process that she was going through and it wasn't going to be an easy one, but with the support of her family that she can overcome that illness.
You and the people you talked to in the report mentioned that economic stressors are a factor in this. Mendota is a community that's been hit very hard by the drought, even in years where there's a relatively plentiful water. Unemployment there is very high. Is the drought having any impact on the situation? Maybe not even this situation in particular, but is that an issue that people there are concerned about when it comes to mental health?
It is. I've talked to a lot of the experts, and even in this case, Sylvia's husband is a farm worker. He works in the fields around that area, and he said that the drought has made the economy, made their budget really tight, and those troubles affect their house and affect how they're going to live, and kind of not knowing where the future is gonna lie ahead. So that's one of the worries that Sylvia had, economic issues and also caring for her two sons. So definitely the drought's affecting everyone in that community, and it's making people add more stressors, especially in Sylvia's case.
Dr. Sablon has years of experience, decades of experience out in Fireball. What does she typically see? She treats not only patients with physical conditions, but also she sees a lot of these cases where individuals are dealing with a mental illness as well. What does she typically see?
Well, it's interesting. She said that it took her a lot of years of experience. I mean, she's had more than 3 decades of experience. And she finally came to realize that a lot of the people that have mental health issues first go see their primary care doctor. But over a physical complaint, she was saying that in most common women go with stomach problems. So maybe they don't even realize that they have a mental illness, but they say that they're having stomach issues, and they do a lot of visits frequently. And what she needs the patient to understand that maybe they are having a stomach problem, maybe they're not, but underlying that all is a mental health issue, or in that case, depression. She said that a lot of women that go with mental health and stomach problems is actually because they're going through a major depression. And, you know, like in Sylvia's case, they have an aid in 15 days. So that's going to transcend into a physical problem as well.
Well, certainly an interesting story. Deanna Aguilera from FM 89, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Joining us now to continue the discussion about mental health in the San Joaquin Valley, we have John Kappenman. He is the director of the San Joaquin Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. Dr. Kappenman, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mental health is an issue that many of us have talked about for years in the Valley as a significant problem. This study that came out last year showed the Valley has among the highest rates of serious mental illness in the state, and also has the fewest number of providers. How does the Affordable Care Act play into the world of mental health in terms of expanding access to care? And there are some changes that it has brought about. Is it too early to say exactly how that is playing out in the real world? What would those changes be, though?
Well, the Affordable Care Act requires that people who have private insurance that is acknowledged as meeting the criteria of the act provide more or less equal coverage for psychological or mental disorders as it does for other kinds of disorders. The fancy word is mental health parity. And we actually, in 2009, before we passed the Affordable Care Act, passed a National Mental Health Parity Act that required all plans to provide comparable services. And then a number of pieces of the Affordable Care Act actually get to implement and put some force beside that. There is also this idea of the client-centered, patient-centered medical home. As more and more primary care clinics take on that role to seek that certification, which is something strongly encouraged through the Affordable Care Act, they will need to develop the capacity to have a real ongoing relationship. It's kind of a everything old is new again idea. It's kind of like the relationships that your parents might have had with their primary care doc, but it's the idea of somebody who is proactively concerned with your health. Oh, I see that you gained a couple of pounds. You didn't mention it to me as something changed. Or I see that your blood pressure is up a little bit. We don't need to worry, but is something going on? That's the kind of ongoing relationship quality doctoring that will become increasingly present and increasingly the standard of care. And so I think that's a really important part of the Affordable Care Act.
I want to talk about the mental health access issue in a moment, but going back to the report, there was a quote from someone with Fresno County Behavioral Health in the report, and she said that, you know, we don't have any problem talking about the status of our cancer or our blood pressure, but we have in society a hesitancy to talk about the state of our mental health. Do you think there's a dialogue that needs to happen or change in attitudes? We've seen so much talk about mental health from policymakers and politicians when it comes to a situation where we have a tragedy like had recently with the murders in the Santa Barbara area. We can expand access. We can do these other things. But is there also something else that needs to happen in terms of our national discussion about mental health issues from mild to the severe?
At the risk of taking that broader than the question goes, I think we have in our society a tendency to blame people for bad luck. We blame people who get cancer. The person who gets cancer, yeah, they can talk about it, but they feel quite a bit of stigma. The person who's got heart out of control diabetes or out of control high blood pressure, who's really overweight, whatever that difference, our society doesn't make dealing with that difference in an open and straightforward way easy. We attach all kinds of levels of blaming the individual, blaming their family, blaming their social context. I think that in our region, we've had a fiercely competitive culture. We really promote the idea that people need to sink or swim on their own. We promote the idea that if people live in bad life circumstances, they ought to just move on. That really is part of the popular culture here. And that's a culture in which it's very difficult to acknowledge any fault, let alone acknowledge mental illness. I don't want to tell the whole story, but my doctor recently got in trouble, and I have to change primary care doctor. I find myself feeling so embarrassed, so stigmatized as the patient for being in that situation. And clearly I'm not responsible. But if I respond in that kind of emotional way to someone else's mistake that sort of vaguely relates to my care, imagine what it's like if you realize, well, gee, I should have stayed on that medication and I didn't. Or, gee, I should have gone back and checked in when I was thinking about pulling out a gun or whatever it was. You know, that we have to create much more sense of accepting all of each other's challenges as challenges that we face as a community. And when you see something like the UCB murders this week, I think that really emphasizes that point, that this young man is allowed to move forward in life with this level of anxiety without greater intervention, says not just something about his bad fortune, but really becomes the bad fortune of a whole community.
You do a lot of work at the Institute looking at disparities in health outcomes in the Valley, looking at different neighborhoods. One neighborhood has a life expectancy very different than another. But even beyond that, looking statewide, are there some places in California that get mental health issues, I don't want to say right, but do a better job at it than maybe in the Valley?
Affluent places. That's really the answer.
Is it just a resource issue, or are there strategies, other things beyond, or is it just we need to have this many more clinicians and this much more access?
Oh, I think it goes well beyond clinicians and access. If you look at our most affluent communities in California, each adolescent faces the challenge of selecting among too many resources in terms of positive youth development activities. Am I going to go to the soccer camp and the drama camp, or am I only going to do the computer science course on campus all summer, high school campus all summer? So that depth of resources for young people, families as they're going through family formation. We have some wonderful programs going on in Fresno County to support young couples and learning how to be parents, and yet they're very small in scale. We don't have the kind of big, broad social movement level group discussions. And you find those things in more affluent communities. People are, perhaps less concerned with how they're going to eat dinner tomorrow. And so there's more times to sort of move on up to those issues of mental health and well-being. I am not saying that we have to become a rich place in order to solve this, in order to address high levels of psychological distress in our community. And we've got to acknowledge that there are members of our community who express more and less of these stresses. So some of the new work that we've been doing actually speaks right to that. And there's a policy brief out that's beginning to be disseminated, shared around. And we've been looking at how neighborhoods in Fresno and throughout the Valley differ not just in who lives and who dies, but who gets sick and how long people are ill, the burden of illness, how much hospitalization. And we find these dramatic effects in Fresno where people in our lowest income neighborhoods, our most racially and economically segregated neighborhoods, face much, much higher levels of hospitalization for mental health and mental health related disorders, as they do for many other disorders. So the quality of people's lives dramatically impacts these outcomes. And so we can decide to make a really concerted effort in Fresno to begin to offer and to have available in our less affluent communities the kinds of social supports, the kinds of informal opportunities, and starting with young people. Every young person ought to have that challenge of deciding which positive youth development program they're going to join, not the challenge of can I do something.
Before we go, one final thought. The Valley is in many areas is lacking in a lot of the specialists that we have in the bigger cities. There's been a lot of effort in the Valley in addressing the primary care physicians shortage. When it comes to mental health clinicians, specialists along those lines, is there any effort underway, any strategy out there to try to increase the number of those specialists who practice here in the Valley, or any approach thereof? Because obviously, in the big cities have the big draw. They right. have all sorts of amenities, and that goes for physicians of all sorts. What do you think the Valley could do to try to increase the supply of those professionals?
I think that there are two strategies that are really being talked about actively now. One is increasing the training and the supply of various kinds of other professionals in mental health. So Fresno State has an excellent program training nurses to be mental health professionals, wonderful programs in social work, wonderful programs in counselor education. All of these kinds of programs need to be encouraged and supported, and we need to, you know, let bright young people know about those opportunities. And there is considerable discussion about how to continue to draw down federal funds, to change the definitions of state laws so that we can continue to grow our supply of the power professionals, the not the doctor, but everybody else who can work with the mentally ill. So I think that that's really important. And as we grow our supply of those people, that's part of what attracts doctors. It's a vibrant healthcare marketplace. So that's one strategy, and we're doing this, and we can do more of it. I really want to emphasize that our challenge, we're talking again about that top of the iceberg, and people don't just emerge instantly severely mentally ill. And many people who have the psychiatric conditions to be, quote, severely mentally ill, find ways to be managed within families and communities. And so we've really got to not get too caught up in these most extreme cases. They're very important to talk about, but we also really need to talk about mental illness. To what extent, when you go to the doctor on a regular basis, is somebody asking you about depression and anxiety? To what extent are teachers, are people working in pharmacies, or people working in health clubs, every place where people have personal relationships, to what extent are those professionals trained to identify and interact with people about obvious changes in their mood and well-being? Unless we can sort of change that professional culture, both inside of medicine, but in a broader set of professionals who have deep and personal relationships with people in identifying and referring for mental health services, that's going to be just as important as increasing the supply of the most highly paid professionals.
We've been talking with John Kappman. He is the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. Mr. Kappman, thank you so much for joining us today. And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk about an effort to end veteran and chronic homelessness in the city of Fresno. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. Last week on our program, we launched a new series of special reports on the lives of Valley veterans on the home front called Common Threads. Today, we continue the discussion in another direction. Last week, the city of Fresno announced its participation in a nationwide program, 25 Cities Initiative, to end veteran and chronic homelessness by 2015. Joining us today to tell us more about the effort is Sarah Mirhadi from the Poverello House and Teresa Guardado from the Fresno VA. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Sarah. How much of a problem is homelessness in today's world amongst the veteran community, or how many veterans make up a portion of the homeless community in Central Valley?
Well, I believe about 30%, and I believe the VA probably has a better count of that than I do. But I know in our population, we do see quite a few veterans coming in, some of them coming in as from, you know, the Vietnam War. A lot of those types of veterans that come in, they've been injured, they have been suffering from severe PTSD or mental illness. And so we do see those quite a bit that come through our doors.
And turning to you, Teresa, is this something that, is there a trend here? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? What's the state of homelessness amongst the veteran community, maybe even beyond this area?
Well, homeless veterans has been a big issue nationwide. And especially here in Fresno, we tend to have around 400 to 500 homeless veterans in the Valley. And the VA is helping. The goal and the mission of the VA and the homeless program is to end homelessness within the veterans in our community.
Turning back to you, Sarah, this new effort, 25 Cities, you had a workshop for various professionals who are on the front lines dealing with this problem just a few days ago. What came out of that? What are you hoping to accomplish with this new program?
Well, we were very excited. Myself and Teresa did participate in a two-day basically boot camp, as you would say, of all different agencies. About 15 agencies participated together to launch something called the 25 Cities. And what the 25 Cities is, Fresno had participated in the 100,000 Homes campaign. And that was participated by various agencies and run through the continuum of care. Because of its success and the amount of people we were able to place into permanent housing that were homeless, the national spotlight came on Fresno, this time for a positive way. So we were very excited to be chosen among 25 cities, and we were in such cities such as San Diego and Phoenix, have also been chosen to participate in this launch. So basically what we're going to do is for 100 days, all of us agencies, including the VA, the Housing Authority, county, city agencies, are going to come together, and we are going to try to house over 60 high-priority individuals in permanent housing. We are all going to come together. We're going to roll up our sleeves and get together on a daily basis to figure out how we're going to house 60 individuals in housing.
And that's sort of the first tier of individuals you're dealing with. And then there's also another 200 veterans you hope to survey. Tell me more about how this goes on, because those are the highest priority, the ones that are most likely to have success in a permanent housing situation. You also have others that you're dealing with trying to provide bridge housing and other things. How do you sort of triage the situation?
So what we're going to do, first we're going to start out, our agencies are all going to participate in putting an outreach team. I know that Pavarillo House is doing that. I know that the VA is doing that. WestCare, Clinica Sierra, and there's a whole lot of other agencies that I please forgive me if I do not remember them, that we're going to get together and put in an outreach team. And with this outreach team is we're going to go out to various places where we think that homeless people will be. And what we'll do is we'll have a survey. And based on that survey, they'll rank from 0 to 20. 20 being the most person that is vulnerable to be homeless, which means probably you are homeless or you're going to be homeless immediately and whatnot. So once we rank, we will take the top tier of those categories, usually if they fall between 10 and 20, and try to go and house those individuals in housing. Now, the thing of it is that it's just not just a survey, because, okay, we have these individuals, but a lot of these individuals that have been homeless lack a lot of documents. They don't have ID, they don't have proof of income, they don't have various documents indicating. They also don't have documents indicating their veteran status. And that's where we are going to try to do is after we survey these people is sit there and work with the VA to get these documents so they can be document ready to enter housing, whether it's income verification, whether it's VA status. We also do basic ID. You'd be surprised about how many people don't even have a driver's license or a California identification license, or have lost their social security number. So we are going to work together with those agencies to get those documents ready for them.
Turning again to Teresa Guardado, the Fresno VA. Sarah was talking about the challenges in many of these vets. They don't have the documents. Interfacing the system has to be a challenge. When some of these vets interact with the VA system in some way, is that an opportunity of contact to try to attach resources or bring access to resources to these individuals? How do you go about that?
Yes, the VA has a homeless program with staff that will help the veterans get them their IDs, get them their DD-214, which is their discharge papers from the military. And there's a lot of agencies that will help out with providing paying for these cost of documents. A lot of our veterans also do not have any income, and they need funding for that. And we have agencies that will help out, like Central Valley Vets, San Joaquin Valley Vets. There's a grant that has been provided for the veterans to assist with these type of funds, along with security deposits, so these veterans could be provided with some housing.
Sarah, before we go, if people out there listening right now want to help, in what way can they do that?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because there is a great, painless way to help. What we're very excited with is that we're also partnering with the City of Fresno through the Fresno First Steps Homes. You've heard Mayor Ashley Swearingen talk about this program. Well, they are going to go ahead and be an integral partner in this. So there's several ways that we can do that. You can go on the website on www.fresnofirststepshome.org and make a donation. And there's a big sign that says donation. And you can put an amount of money, because what is the city doing is, like us agencies, they're making a commitment. We're going to leverage city resources and private resources to get enough money to go ahead and house all these people. So also what you can do, you can text a donation to HOME to 85944, and $10 will automatically be donated to Fresno First Steps Home. And I have to say that the mayor has been very helpful and enthusiastic about this. She has issued a challenge. She would like to raise $100,000 in 100 days for this project. So we're really excited, because it's nice to see that all the agencies plus county and city officials working together to end this problem of chronic homelessness for homeless vets and for other chronic homeless people.
Sarah Mirati of the Poverello House and Teresa Guardado of the Fresno VA, thank you so much for joining us today talking about the new 25 Cities effort to end chronic homelessness amongst the veterans in our community. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. Should parents have the option to determine the definition of death for their children? Jahi McMath's case earlier this year prompted many to ask that question, along with a host of associated ethical concerns. In this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Christopher Myers, professor of philosophy at CSU Bakersfield and a clinical ethicist, says there are medical, scientific, and moral reasons why determinations of death should be left to healthcare experts.
What does it mean to say someone has died? Jahi McMath's tragic story has brought to surface the many confusing ways we talk about death, often with profound moral implications. 13-year-old Jahi, like more than a half million other U.S. children last year, went in for a fairly routine surgical procedure to help with her sleep apnea. Doctors removed her tonsils and adenoids, along with some excess tissue in the back of her throat. Things went terribly wrong, however, right after Jahi's surgery. A ruptured blood vessel resulted in oxygen deprivation to her brain, causing her death. She died, and yet her heart was beating, her chest rose and fell, and her skin was warm. And as we learned as the story progressed, it became clear that other organs, kidneys, liver, digestive tract, also continued to function. How can that be? How can one be dead and yet have a body that appears very much alive? The last 50 years have brought about some amazing medical technologies and skills that effectively keep body parts functioning, typically to allow other organs to heal, but sometimes to preserve those parts after the brain has suffered complete and irreversible damage. Such preservation after death is necessary for organ donation, and it is also sometimes briefly used, to help ease a family's transition to the reality of the death. As amazing as those medical advances are, however, they cannot bring back a dead brain, nor can brains be resuscitated or replaced. Further, when the brain is sufficiently damaged, the rest of the body is completely dependent on medical intervention. Remove the intervention, and the normal decay process rapidly occurs. Indeed, that process occurs even with those interventions. It just happens more slowly. Furthermore, when the brain is gone, we are gone. Our consciousness, our memories, our ability to experience pleasure and pain, indeed to experience anything at all, is gone. Some sense of self may survive in the afterlife, but survival in bodily form is lost. This is why every state in the country has adopted whole brain death as the legal definition of death of the person. Hence the horrible tragedy of Jahi's case. Her family experienced the terrible shock of a medical occurrence that seemingly should not happen to a healthy 13-year-old, but it did. She died, and no amount of wishing, no court order, no continuing medical intervention will change that. But isn't it the family's right to retain such false hope? I would say no. First, they do not have the right to determine their own definition of death. That's a medical decision based on the best available science. Second, they cannot demand that a hospital continue to provide scarce resources when there is no associated benefit, not just an ICU bed, but countless hours of time for hospital personnel and lawyers. Further, I worry about how all of this is affecting Jahai's family, especially the other children. The associated emotional and financial harms will undoubtedly have a lasting impact. In short, and like it or not, Benjamin Franklin was right. Death and taxes continue to be certain, and no amount of wishing or hoping will make it otherwise. For The Moral Is, this is Christopher Myers.
The commentary series The Moral Is a production of the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State, this week in association with the Kegley Institute of Ethics at California State University, Bakersfield. The views expressed are those of the commentator and don't necessarily reflect those of the university or the institute. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. There's a new exhibit opening this weekend in Bakersfield. Of course, the first weekend of the month is often a very busy one for local arts fans. In Fresno, the first Thursday of the month is home for the regular Art Hop event. And then in Bakersfield, it's First Fridays, which generates a lot of attention. This Friday, it's a new exhibit opening at the Metro Galleries in downtown Bakersfield, the Instagram exhibit. Joining us now to tell us more is Don Martin from the Metro Galleries. Don, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. This exhibit is interesting, and I should say in the interest of disclosure, Valley Public Radio is in a way a part of this as one of our reporters. In fact, the producer for this program, Ezra David Romero, is a part of the exhibit through our Voices of the Drought series. Tell us about how this exhibit came about, the Instagram exhibit.
Well, Ezra actually was in Bakersfield around the holiday, around Christmas, and we were having dinner just right across the street from my gallery here at the Noodle Bar, and we were talking about social networking and, you know, the advent of everybody having a phone on their camera and these great apps such as Instagram. I use mine quite a bit. Ezra uses his quite a bit. And so we got to discussing, you know, the thought of bringing art involved and how really anybody, you know, is a photographer. I don't know that they're always good, but anyway, anybody can take a picture. So we, you know, started this discussion that night and kind of batted around these ideas about using Instagram for the exhibit and creating, you know, hashtags that would go for each of our pieces of the exhibit. I've owned my gallery now for 7 years. I've never been a part of an art exhibit here or anywhere else. I don't consider myself an artist, but I take photos of Kern County when I run or I cycle every day, and I've had people make the suggestion, Don, you should show these, or you should, you know, print these out. So I've chosen about 30 pieces, trying to whittle it down to about 20 that I'll be showing. And my portion of the exhibit is called My California, and Ezra's, which is here, he brought down this weekend, is fabulous. The Drought Voices series, it is really, really good.
Turning now to Ezra, you've been taking these Instagram photos as part of our reporting project. When you go out and report on a story about the drought, you take these photos, but also on other...
Just during my life.
Exactly.
You know, I'm a product of Central California. I was raised here. I work here. And, you know, the drought's really affecting everywhere I go. You know, I go to Millerton Lake and the water's really low, and I go kayaking on the river and it's... The water's about a foot and a half lower. I report in Mendota and work with farm workers or whatever. I'm just taking photos, kind of an overflow of my work already in my life, just observing, really.
How do you think the advent of mobile phone photography changes what we document? Because I forget who said this. It was someone famous a long time ago. I should probably look it up. But someone said the best camera is the one you have with you. It's not always about having the latest Canon Mark II D5 with the great lens. It's about being able to capture that image in the moment. What do you think about that and what you've been able to capture with very advanced technology, but it's
with a broken cell phone. Yeah. With a shattered screen cell phone.
Yeah.
Like I wrote in my artist statement, like I have a DSLR, but my cell phone is always with me and it's everywhere I go. So I'm just going to use what I have. And with Instagram, it's just a great tool to showcase our work. And it's simple and it's really fast to use. That's why.
Don, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree. I mean, the story in the news yesterday about the guy in San Francisco that so the FBI and everybody was looking for that apparently had written this suicide note and posted it online, and he was, had these chemicals in his apartment. And when he was discovered yesterday, there were two people with their iPhones shooting video of it. I mean, it's everywhere. For me, when I'm running or cycling throughout Kern County, in my head, I see the photo. I look at a sunset, or I look at a pump jack, or I look at, these things that I see, and I think our area is very beautiful. And so I see those shots, compose them in my head, and I take that picture. And it's great to be able to, transfer what your vision is that is either being posted on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or printed out and shown on a wall in a gallery.
Now, of course, listeners out there can also contribute their own photos to our online blog, Voices of the Drought. Just go to kvpr.org and you can submit your own photos. Don, before we go, this exhibit opens on First Friday, this Friday, at the Metro Galleries in downtown Bakersfield, but it is up throughout the whole month. Is that right?
It will be up for 2 months through the end of July. In addition to Ezra and myself, we have one other artist who I actually met through Instagram. His name is Adam Areola. He's a local guy. His part of the exhibit is called Adam's Golden State of Mind. He travels California quite a bit. Beautiful photos throughout California. And we also opened it up to anyone, basically anyone in the world who has an Instagram account. So we have some entries from as far away as Europe. I got a piece this morning from New Orleans. I have a piece from Canada, and have several here from the Valley. So that exhibit will be on the upstairs portion of the gallery. So I think it's going to be something really interesting, and I think it's going to be pretty good.
Well, I definitely am looking forward to it. We'll be there on Friday to check it out again. This is the new exhibit, the Instagram exhibit at the Metro Galleries, 1604 19th Street in downtown Bakersfield. Don Martin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
We'll be right back in just a moment and talk to Fresno's new fire chief, Carrie Donis, about the rash of fires that have recently hit the city and also about being the first woman to lead the Fresno Fire Department. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. Earlier this year, Carrie Donis made history, becoming the first woman to lead the Fresno Fire Department. It's a big job protecting a city of over 500,000 residents, with a department that's faced years of budget cuts. Chief Donis joins us now on Valley Edition. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's been a very busy day so far. Two major fires last night, one at a commercial recycling facility in South Fresno and another downtown on the Fulton Mall. We have had a number of big fires recently, specifically downtown. Bring us up to date on the fires that happened last night and this morning.
Sure. It's been a very busy morning. Our crews have been – we had a five-alarm fire at the Barrios recycling facility. We've had that before. There's probably, 60 or 70 firefighting personnel on scene. And they still are on scene, not quite as many, but that's a defensive fire, and we'll be mopping that up for probably days because that's a deep-seated fire. The other one broke about 2:15 this morning, and that was the Proctor Jeweler right there on the Fulton Mall and Fresno Street. That's still undetermined, the cause, but we had at least 8 units and 25 personnel on scene. That was a very strenuous working fire. We had a lot of resources there, and usually we can rotate them out with a second alarm and rehab those crews, but they had to take breaks and then get back in there and fight some more fire and pull some ceilings, so it was very strenuous for them.
These major fires would strain any department. Talk about the lack of elasticity there when these major events happen. We saw it also recently with the major fire in the old Del Monte packing house down by Chuck Chancey Park, right across the street essentially from the fire department headquarters. And then just 4 days ago with the warehouse, the Ace Tire warehouse on Ventura. These are big events that stress the department.
Yeah, these are very large fires that do put stressors on our department. We do have great partnerships with some of our neighboring agencies that they commit resources into our city as well. Those are called automatic aid agreements, and vice versa, we assist them when they have large incidents, such as the Ford dealership fire in Clovis, where we helped them. These fires are very close in proximity. They are still undetermined. There is some cause for concern, but they do require a significant amount of firefighting personnel and apparatus to mitigate that emergency. And so our sources are strapped pretty thin. Tonight, early this morning, was a kind of the perfect storm where we depleted all of our resources in the city for a short period of time, and then we had some apparatus break free and cover some other parts of the cities. But during those times, we have to stop responding to medical emergencies, and American Ambulance has to be the only provider to do that.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Fresno Fire Chief Kerry Donis. The fire department has been dealing with a very busy morning so far. Some major fires, one at a recycling facility in South Fresno and another at a jewelry store in the Fulton Mall. Just a few days ago, I saw on the Fire Union, the local 753's Twitter account, and they posted, this is back on, I guess, May 25th, Fresno Fire is down to only three truck companies in the fifth largest city in California. And the firefighters there went on to explain that many of the city's ladder trucks simply aren't operable right now. What is the situation with the equipment that Fresno Fire has right now?
Well, all of our equipment gets used excessively because we are such a busy fire department. We run about 38,000 calls a year. 60 to 80% of those are medical emergencies. The balance are fires and rescue and other calls. But fire trucks are about 80,000-pound pieces of equipment, and they really weren't intended to run 15 calls a day. But that's the position we're in due to the economic times, for the last 4 or 5 years. Now, I have to say that, the city administration has recognized this and have really poured resources last year and this year in this year's proposed budget into improving that. We have were approved for 3 engines and a truck last year. In this year's proposed budget, we have 4 engines, a truck, and a water tender proposed to be replaced. That's almost half of our frontline fleet. We keep going on that path. We will be able to replenish our apparatus and our light vehicle fleet as appropriate. Because they're wearing out, and that causes a lot of maintenance cost as well.
It's not just the equipment. It's also the personnel as well that face a huge stress in these sorts of events. As you mentioned earlier, the new proposed city budget would also increase the minimum daily staffing for the Fresno Fire Department from 67 to 71. What does that mean in real terms?
Oh, that's really kind of another exciting piece for our members and for our firefighting staff. We were at 66 firefighters on duty for such a long time, so so many years. And what that means is on duty each day, there's only 66 people that will respond to emergencies. For a metro-sized city, a 500,000 population or more, you'll never find a department with that few people. But that's the economic times we were in. And our folks rallied and have done a tremendous job with less resources for many years. In the proposed budget, they approved the SAFER grant, which allowed us to add 4 additional firefighters on duty each day. That's a tremendous push. They've also proposed in this budget to add another company. What does that mean? That means we have now a 2-company house that for, let's say, a truck that runs 15 calls a day, it now will only run maybe 6. And that first-line piece of equipment, an engine in this case, would be run those calls first and add more resources and companies in the busiest areas of our community.
want to turn now to your story. You took the official title of Fresno Fire Chief after the interim title earlier this year, becoming the first woman to lead the department. You've been serving the city for over 18 years now with the Fresno Fire Department. Did you ever, when you started out 18 years ago, did you ever have in mind that you would one day have the have that badge of Fire Chief?
Honestly, I think I always wanted to do something more. I came into this not knowing I was going to be a firefighter. I never knew about the career until someone kind of threw it out there when I was about 27, and it fit nicely and, quite frankly, perfectly into my past life as a student athlete. And so once I got in there, I wanted to compete for the next position, and I took every promotional opportunity that was available to me just to compete, and I thought management was the best fit for me. I love being a firefighter. I love being on the engines and trucks and driving them and being on the crews, but I think I can make a difference, and I think I have in the last 12 years in administration at that level, and I think this was the pinnacle of my, the last step in my career path, and I love to be the fire chief in the city in which I live. It's a great honor.
Before we go, I imagine as fire chief you're very busy, but do you get any chance to talk to young people, especially young women and girls who see you as a role model, young boys for that matter as well. What's that like?
Absolutely. I love to give back to the community. I've been a coach for many years for youth, softball and soccer. It's important to be a great role model, whether it's for a female or a male. I try to do that in a positive way, and if I can help others with some of my words or some of my examples to promote this career, but also to be a good person and give back to your community, then I think that's well worth it, and I look for those opportunities every place I can.
Well, we certainly, thank you so much for joining us today and wish your crew of firefighters out there the best and safe safety as they work to keep the city safe and put down those blazes. Fresno Fire Chief Carrie Donis, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can let us know what you think by sending us a tweet at KVPR or sending us an email, talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.